Wimbledon winner Venus was first to advance. The seventh seed earned her seventh trip to the finale at the All England Club with a victory over fifth seed Elena Dementieva. Two-time champion Serena followed with a triumph over China's Zheng Ji. Rainer Schüttler will play in his first Wimbledon semifinal tomorrow. The German saved a match point in the fifth set and went on to defeat Arnaud Clément in a quarterfinals match that was tied at a set apiece yesterday evening when play was called because of fading light. Next up for Schüttler will be two-time runner-up and second seed Rafael Nadal. Tomorrow's other men's semifinal will pit five-time champion Roger Federer against Murat Safin. The Chicago White Sox will try to win 10 straight home games for the first time since 2006 when they open a four-game series with the Oakland Athletics tonight. The Cardinals will wrap up a four-game series with the New York Mets at Busch Stadium. The Cards have already won two of the games against the Mets. St. Louis hasn't taken a regular season series from the Mets since May of 2006, but the Cards beat New York in seven games in the NL Championship Series later that year before winning the World Series. The NL Central leading Chicago Cubs tonight will try to earn a rare road series win. The Cubs will face off with the San Francisco Giants in the finale of a four-game series. Top NBA draft pick Derrick Rose is slated to have his first full practice with the Chicago Bulls tonight. It's the start of a four-day mini camp at the team's practice center in suburban Chicago. Tiger Woods' signature golf tournament in suburban Washington, D.C. is underway with the host at home recovering from surgery on his left leg. And Indiana University says it will give up two basketball scholarships for the upcoming season in anticipation of penalties related to the NCAA's academic progress rate. The university says the move is partially related to the number of players who have left since the end of the 2007-2008 season. That's a look at sports.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Ratio Architects, designers of the M2 on Neal mixed-use project in downtown Champaign, on the web at ratioarchitects.com.
It's 2:42. The Food and Drug Administration continues to investigate the source of tainted tomatoes that sickened more than 160 people. It's narrowing down the source of the salmonella bacteria and has lifted a ban on tomato sales in many states. Julie Grant reports on how the ban has affected tomato growers.
It's been a tough June for Florida tomato growers, who grow 90% of the nation's tomatoes. It's not that they've been working too hard, it's that they haven't been able to work. Lisa Lockridge is with the Florida Fruit and Vegetable Association.
Business pretty much ground to a halt for Florida tomato growers. There was tomatoes out in the fields left. There were tomatoes in the packing houses just sitting there. There were tomatoes on trucks that were being turned away.
Lockridge says Florida growers will have lost $500 million as a result of the ban. Now that the ban's been lifted in Florida, she says growers are restarting business and shipping tomatoes to the stores, cafeterias, and restaurants that want them. For the Environment Report, I'm Julie Grant.
The Environment Report is a production of Michigan Radio. Support comes from the Joyce Foundation, the George Gund Foundation, and USDA's Cooperative Extension Service. Have something to say about the Environment Report? Send email to feedback@environmentreport.org.
Archaeologists working in Virginia say they've found the childhood home of George Washington. It took 7 years of digging to uncover the crucial evidence. There was no sign of a cherry tree or a hatchet, but archaeologists say they found a trove of household items that could reveal a great deal about Washington's childhood years. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports.
The Ferry Farm has long been known as the one-time property of Augustine Washington, George Washington's father, and the likely site of George's childhood home. It's situated on a terrace overlooking the Rappahannock River in rural Virginia. But the problem, says archaeologist David Muraka, was that there were five houses buried there.
We weren't sure where in the puzzle the Washington house was. We knew that there were several houses out there, and we needed a sort of find the one that we were looking for.
Muraka and colleagues with the George Washington Foundation started digging 7 years ago. Eventually, they ruled out the other four houses as too recent. When they got to the last house, there wasn't much to see. Most of the stone in the original foundations had been removed in later centuries to build other homes. But in what remained, there was a crucial clue: mortar that contained oyster shell, a trademark of 18th century building in the region. The archaeologists found root cellars and foundations for two fireplaces. In the cellars, they uncovered painted plaster from walls and ceilings, animal bones, broken earthenware, glass, and lots of straight pins. And they found evidence of a fire.
We found ash. We found people were pushing ash and a lot of burnt domestic artifacts, burnt plaster, into the bottom of that root cellar because they were abandoning it.
Historical documents describe a fire that burned down the Washington home on Christmas Eve in 1740. But Maraca says they found sheets of unburned plaster on top of the burned material. That suggests that the fire did not consume the whole house and that the family rebuilt the burned section. Maraca says all this evidence led them to conclude that this was, in fact, George Washington's boyhood home. It was a good-sized home, 50 feet by 37 feet, but he says the artifacts show how the Washington's fortunes reversed.
They start the beginning of the 1740s as a sort of a regional gentry. They have pretty good lives, and then the series of misfortunes occur.
George's sister dies. Then they have the house fire, and in 1743, George's father dies. The elder Washington's will leaves most of the family wealth to his two sons from a previous marriage. George's mother, Mary Washington, and her family see their income drop. Maraca says there's little evidence in the house of the material things, fancy dishware or decorative figurines that a genteel 18th century family would normally own.
George Washington's mother stays on the property until 1772, so almost her entire life is spent on that property. And you don't see until the very end of her stay there that the material niceties start to reappear.
At a press conference at the National Geographic Society, which supported the research, archaeologist Philip Levy of the University of South Florida said the discovery opens a door for lots of new research.
The childhood period is poorly understood. Now, we are in position now to begin to understand that childhood in a level of detail that has heretofore not been possible for scholars of any type.
The scientists say it will take years to sort through and analyze all the artifacts. They also plan to rebuild the house using period tools and materials similar to those available in the early 18th century. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
It's 2:48. For quite a while now, reporters and political opponents have been dissecting Illinois Senator Barack Obama's career, analyzing exactly what made his meteoric rise possible. People have picked through his voting record, who he selected as political mentors, which law firm he chose to work for. Today we take a look at one of the first and most basic decisions Obama made to get his start: which Chicago neighborhood to move to. Many Chicagoans know his neighborhood of Hyde Park has a special niche in the city, its history and its politics. Ben Calhoun reports on how Hyde Park helped make Barack Obama.
I'm standing at 5429 South Harper Avenue. I'm outside of this three-story brick apartment building. This is the building where Barack Obama lived when he was a community organizer here back in the late 1980s. This is on the eastern edge of Chicago's Hyde Park neighborhood. Of course, after he lived here, he went to Harvard Law and then came back with plans to get into politics. In 1992, he married Michelle Robinson, and the couple was faced with the decision of where to move and build Obama's political career. Out of all the places they could have picked, they ended up settling on a condo about five blocks east of here, where they lived until 2005.
It was to his advantage that he started in Hyde Park.
Timuel Black is a Chicago historian and educator. For decades, he's lived in Kenwood, the neighborhood just north of Hyde Park. Black is also a friend of Obama's and occasionally advised him when he was getting started. Black says from the beginning, Hyde Park and Obama were a match. On one side, you had one of the most unique neighborhoods in the city.
Liberal, intellectual, and active.
In a city that's one of the most racially segregated in the nation, Hyde Park is integrated, a good fit for Obama's complex mixed-race background. In a city of blue-collar credentials, Hyde Park revolves around the University of Chicago, a good fit for Obama's Harvard Law intellectual background. In a city dominated by machine-style politics, Hyde Park has a history of electing independents, appealing to Obama, who made an effort to keep his distance from the city's political machine. Black says then, you had Obama's appeal to the neighborhood.
He had the education, style, charisma, a beautiful wife who was with him and had grown up not necessarily in Hyde Park, but close to Hyde Park, but having friends all over Hyde Park. And he had ambition, and he was relatively young.
Black says the neighborhood was also more understanding about some things that might have been problems for Obama in other parts of the city, like that he's not a Chicago native and he could be viewed as highbrow intellectual. Do you think a candidate like a Barack Obama, a part-time law professor at the University of Chicago, mm-hmm. could have gotten his start in any other area of the city?
I seriously doubt whether he could have progressed even to the point of running for state senate in any other part of the city.
It would have been a lot harder, and it would have been a lot slower.
Abner Mikva is a former federal judge, White House counsel, congressman, and a longtime Hyde Park resident. He's also a friend and advisor of Obama.
It was a natural for him to settle here. First of all, the fact that he was an outsider caused no problems for him at all. They couldn't care less that he'd been here 3 months or 30 years.
In 1996, Obama won a state Senate district that's anchored by Hyde Park. And in the following years, he learned the political strengths and weaknesses of the neighborhood. In 2000, he faced the limitations of his neighborhood support when he launched a doomed bid against Congressman Bobby Rush, performing dismally outside of Hyde Park. Later, he took advantage of his independent Hyde Park base. Mikva says it was part of what allowed him to rise so rapidly and part of what put him in position for his 2004 Senate run.
He was able to leap ahead in Democratic Party circles, even though he wasn't going the regular route of being a precinct captain and running for the city council and then the state legislature and then 20 years later for the Congress and then 10 years later, if he's lucky, for the Senate. He's leapfrogged all those places because it is Hyde Park. He has a base independent of the party apparatus.
Since he catapulted to the national level, Obama's relationship with the neighborhood has changed, especially with some of the people who helped him get his start. He's still very popular in Hyde Park, but behind closed doors and not for attribution, some local leaders will tell you, after his primary win for U.S. Senate, Obama cut ties with some of his early supporters in ways that left some sour feelings. There's also a notable split among Hyde Park supporters who were there at the beginning and watched Obama's climb.
Okay, my name is Alan Mora Dobry.
I'm Lois Friedberg Dobry.
Alan Dobry and Lois Friedberg Dobry have lived in Hyde Park since the 1950s. They're prominent political activists in the neighborhood and longtime grassroots organizers. Alan Dobry was a Democratic Party committeeman in Hyde Park for 16 years. In 1996, Obama ensured his primary win for state Senate by challenging all his opponents' nominating petitions, knocking them all off the ballot. The Dobrys helped him do it.
We were able to show that all these petitions had very serious errors.
But these days, the Dobrys take slightly different views on Obama. Both still support him. But as Obama has risen to national prominence, on the local level, he's allied himself more closely with the city's political machine, including an endorsement of Chicago Mayor Richard Daley. That bothers Allen, who says it goes against Obama's Hyde Park roots.
We got him elected as an anti-machine independent, and he has now cozied up to the machine. That doesn't mean I'm going to vote Republican or work for the Republicans, but I'm less enthusiastic about Barack than when I saw him as an anti-machine independent.
Lois says she doesn't like seeing Obama ally himself with the political forces Hyde Park traditionally fought, but she understands it.
I still look at, you know, the way he votes. The way he votes in the Senate hasn't changed measurably. He's been a legislator for 13 years. I don't see that he has changed his basic agenda, but I do see that he has looked at the ways of implementing that agenda and has learned what you have to do to get some of it through.
I asked historian Timuel Black what he thought of the Dobrys' differences of opinion. He says it doesn't surprise him because Alan is a purist and Lois is a realist. Black says he understands both sides and he's heard that debate among Hyde Parkers before. Ultimately, he says he wonders how Hyde Park's values might be reflected in an Obama administration, especially since Obama wouldn't be where he is without Hyde Park. I'm Ben Calhoun.
A 200-pound cast iron manhole cover isn't supposed to be moved, at least not easily.
Oops. There's a pick hole side here to help pop it up.
But across the country, thieves are managing to make off with manhole covers at an alarming rate.
The theft of these has really ratcheted way up, and it's become a real problem.
The latest in street crime later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 Central on AM 580 WILL Urbana.
Join us Saturday evening at 6 for the next edition of Sidetrack. Each month you'll hear stories and interviews on topics just a little off the main line. Host Jason Croft is your guide on this delightful excursion. It's stories, interviews, music, and more on Sidetrack. Saturday night at 6 here on AM 580. And we hope you'll join us Sunday afternoon at 1 for Media Matters with your host, Bob McChesney. Every week, Bob talks with someone on the cutting edge of media. This week, Bob's guest is Amy Goodman, co-founder, executive producer, and host of Democracy Now! This week's program was pre-recorded, so no phone calls will be taken. That's Media Matters, Sunday afternoon at 1.
Earth and Sky.
Nick Bostrom is director of the Future of Humanity Institute at Oxford University. He's organized a 2008 conference for scientists to gather to discuss catastrophic risks. Those are potential events that could threaten your existence and mine and the whole human species.
Nuclear proliferation, biological weapons, pandemic disease, despotism, various forms of social and economic collapse scenarios rank high on the list of near to midterm potential catastrophes.
Humans have experienced global catastrophes in the past, Bostrom said, but modern technology has brought new potential risks.
We have risks that arise from powerful new technologies that we might develop, such as advanced nanotechnology and superintelligent machines.
He said the events of this century could determine the survival of our species.
This critical transition period might pose the biggest existential risks for humanity that we've ever faced, because we're developing very powerful technologies that we have no experience with, and it's unclear at this point whether we have the wisdom to use these technologies to our advantage rather than to our destruction.
If you're concerned about surviving a global catastrophe, Bostrom's best advice is to stay healthy. After all, it's still survival of the fittest. I'm Lindsay Patterson for Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future environment. It is part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910.